So that series is called The Four Protective Meditations. And three of them I have already shared with you over the last three times. And today I'm gonna come with the last one. And for those, you know, who haven't been part of the last three ones, I just go over the theme of the four protective meditations before I go to the last one in this group of four. So, you know, the four protective meditations, the list itself isn't found in the suttas, but every one of those four kinds of meditations are found in the suttas. And together, you know, they build a group of four which is considered, you know, to protect the mind from greed, hatred, and delusion in ourselves and in others. So that's the protective quality of those meditations. It's not like a charm or a talisman, but it's a practice, you know, which can protect us because we get to know much more deeply how the mind works. And we also get some instructions on how to stabilize ourselves and, you know, allow the mind to do what it does, but add awareness to it and add different suggestions in, you know, how to observe what's going on and how to relate it to the bigger picture. So they are four different recollections, and the first two show us the potential of a human life, and that's the meditation on the recollection of the Buddha and the meditation on metta or the Brahmaviharas. And the other two, they are working more with the limitations of life and what it means to be a human being. And that's the meditation on the body and the recollection of death. So they all four, you know, work with the realities of human life. Two are more like elevating the mind and the heart, and two are more, you know, going at meeting the attachment and supporting letting go. And together, you know, they can help us to see more clearly the way things truly are and bring some balance and peace to our circumstances by putting them like into a bigger context, into a bigger container. And that's what the Dhamma practice is all about anyway, you know, to establish a bigger container so that what we are experiencing isn't so overwhelming. And what I really like, there's a particular sutta is the salt lamp or the lamp of salt sutta, where, you know, if you take a lump of salt and you put it in a glass of water, the water is most likely, you know, very bitter and not really drinkable. But if you put the same lump of salt into a bathtub, you still can drink the water. You're most likely not going to taste the salt. And that's, you know, the practice of the mind is to encourage the mind to open and to, you know, realize its innate potential for limitlessness. And at least, you know, for making it bigger and bigger, being able to relate our experience in a way, you know, which is in connection with the bigger context and not taking everything so personal because of that. And it helps us, you know, to let go of old patterns of separation and leads, you know, to transformation, really. And allow new ways of seeing and new ways of relating to emerge. And today, you know, we want to particularly speak about the recollection of death, or that's also called Maranasati in Pali. Marana means death, and sati is mindfulness, awareness, so recollection of death. And it's considered, you know, to give us a sense of urgency for the practice. And also, it is considered to be a remedy for heedlessness, and you know, to remember that these bodies of ours, they are only borrowed from nature, borrowed from the planet. They're like a riding animal for consciousness. And you know, reflecting on the impermanence of these bodies, you know, that they emerge out of the planet, and then when the time comes, you know, they go back into it, like the composting back into it, emerging, you know, like a flower through the support of a mother, and then when the time comes, they go back into the ground. And there is some awesomeness about that, you know, to really reflecting on that can be actually uplifting in a very unexpected way. And, you know, bring almost like a sense of relief that this is just part of the circle. And it's at the same time also really the cutting edge of practicing with impermanence. So, you know, and this reflection on death is a practice which is suggested, you know, especially in monasteries, that to be done on a daily basis, actually, you know, that this could be my last day. And even in the suttas, you know, we can find quite a few of the teaching stories, you know, which speak about that, how important it is to recollect death in terms of giving us some energy for practice. And, you know, the remembering the dharma of death is a preparation to the vastness from which we emerge and to which we return. And, you know, because that's something which will come to all of us if we prepare ourselves, if we are considering this and, you know, not try to hold it at arm's length, it's going to be empowering and it will make us more alive, actually. That's a paradox, you know, because some people might think, oh, you know, reflecting on death is a bad thing. It makes you maybe, you know, depressed or whatever. But in reality, it brings more aliveness because it completes something. It completes the circle of how it is, you know, how it is. Everybody who is born dies. And at the moment of birth, death comes along. And it's not like just something for older people, but this is can happen to anybody at any time. Some beings are born, you know, dead or die in the mother's womb. So it's not just something for people who are older. It's something we need to reflect on as a part of living a full life. And earlier on, you know, when our culture wasn't yet so quote-unquote civilized, you know, death wasn't hidden in the same way how it's now. And this is why, in particular, we need this practice now, because we are so separated from that truth. Then can be more of a shock, really. So, you know, there is in particular like two ways how our minds tend to defend against death. And the first one is, you know, pretending that death doesn't really affect me. You know, we kind of know everybody is going to die, but somehow I don't. There's somehow a very weird defense mechanism, which seems to be part and parcel of our equipment, you know, as human beings, that we kind of don't really take that in so deeply. And the second one is, you know, pushing that off into the future, not now, not me and not now. This kind of thoughts, you know, they become apparent if we are working with this recollection on that. Because they can be quite unconscious. But if we start, you know, working in this way with our minds, we start to notice, yes, really, I think that too. I can definitely you know, recognizing myself that I'm not so much thinking about my own death, but it's more like about other people dying and what kind of a effect that would have on me. Because I love them and I, you know, work together with them. So this practice counteracts these two quite unconscious strategies, and it prepares us for living more fully. And, you know, and maybe comes more clear to us what's really important for us. And what do we need to do, you know, in order to maybe, you know, repair certain things before we die, to clarify certain things before we die. Is there anything we need to do so that when we are on our deathbed, you know, that we feel like at ease, that everything has been taken care of to the extent we could. That will make us feel more fully here. Maybe, you know, also it said reflection on death helps us to be able to ask for forgiveness and to be able to easily forgive others because of that reflection. So it really faces ignorance head on and helps us to not so easily get lost, you know, in the world. And interest, you know, in the more kind of consumerist culture, you know, gets a little bit less intense. And there's a sense of urgency in the Nepali language that's called samvega. And a sense of nibbida, which is, you know, translated as disenchantment sometimes, in the sense of, you know, waking up from a spell. And when you literally translate the word nibbida, that means, you know, not finding. Not finding. And what it is, you know, we are not finding unchanging separate entities, but what we are finding is that everything is connected with everything else. And it's constantly changing, and our bodies are no exception. So, you know, it propels us more towards practicing because it's going to be really good to be prepared, you know, when the time comes, so that we can be with that and that we can relate to it and not have to turn away. So able, you know, to face our own death and the death of others. And Ajahn Chah, you know, a very well-known Thai forest master, he said, he's quoted for this very famous short saying, "Die before you die." Very powerful. So then when the time of death comes, you know, you're already able to be steady with it. And, you know, not only the death of, you know, of our bodies, but sometimes, you know, the death of a relationship, the death of a certain way of living, the death of a dream, and the death of the body. To really, you know, pay attention to endings because usually, you know, our minds are much more interested in beginnings, you know, new things and young things, babies and puppies and all of the sweet, sweet things. But they are not really so interested in the old things and in the wilting things and in the composting things. Really, that's not exciting, you know. But this practice, you know, directs the mind to pay attention to that too, and to get more a fuller picture of what it is to be alive. And, you know, our culture generally probably thinks that's a bit of a morbid, crazy way of attending, but it is really very healthy because it has the whole spectrum in view, not just some choice bits. And it brings a certain coolness, to everything. And that coolness, brings a capacity for seeing more clearly. And then we can really see that everything which has a beginning has a middle and an end, not just, the excitement of the beginning, but there is much more to that. So, that is a very unusual practice, I think, and it's not taught very much. But because it's one of the four protective meditations, we are dealing with it today. And so, I want to give a little bit of space if anyone has a question or a comment. And then there is time for announcements. And then afterwards, I will share with you a guided meditation on the theme as well.
I have a question.
Yes, please. Who is that?
This is Isabel.
Isabel. Isabel. Hello, Isabel. Yes, please.
Mean, as you're talking about this, I realized that I knew this all along, is that I'm terrified of death. So what do you do if you're terrified of dying? And I want to, I know it's a very central Buddhist philosophy to face that, but what can you do about that?
Yeah. For example, what we are doing here to do soon, we're going to do a guided meditation, which is a gentle way of conditioning the heart and the mind to slowly inch closer to that which is afraid of. And I would like to ask you, why are you afraid of that? Do you know?
Well, I do know, and this is probably my second question, is that what is the philosophy behind what is beyond? Because I'm afraid I don't know what's beyond, and I'm a bit of a control freak, so that means I don't know what's going to happen, and that's
But you see,
terrifying.
yeah, nobody can really tell you exactly what is afterwards, but what the Buddhist way of thinking speaks about, as long as the heart and the mind of someone, isn't fully liberated from greed, hatred, and delusion, that mind stream will seek another body, and then you'll be reborn again, in a body which is an equivalent to the quality of the mind. So that is what there is nothing really beyond in that sense. In the Christian worldview, we speak about going to heaven and things like that. But in the Buddhist, metaphysics, they are speaking about that consciousness is again, being retaking another body in order to continue to experience and live and continue to purify, consciousness.
So that
So,
it sounds like that's the key, is that as long as we continue practicing and in some ways eradicating greed, hatred, and delusion, we'll be reborn into a body that is at the same level as we're at when we die. So
yes.
it's good encouragement to keep doing that and understanding.
Yes. Yeah.
Oh, that's
Because because if you use your time worrying about what's going to be in the future, then you're not really using your time for practice. And that's the best preparation for whatever is going to happen after you die. The more you have, let go of greed, hatred, and delusion, the better will be the next situation, So if you do, if you're practicing a lot of worrying and being afraid, then your mind, you accumulate more fear, which is a kind of aversion in the mind,
Yeah.
So I think what is really good is to remember, hey, that's not going to be beneficial for me. That's not going to help. That makes things worse. Stop and go and listen to the guided meditation again, or go to the Sangha. Speak with other people about it. And there is even a very beautiful initiative. You could look that up on the internet. It's called Death Cafe. Death Cafe. And they have meetings, where people can meet and speak about death together and about their fears. And then you find out, hey, you know, I'm not alone. I write it in the chat
Yeah, I
because
see it
I,
online.
yeah, Death
Yeah.
Cafe. Yeah. So maybe that would be something good for you know?
Yeah, no, this is great. I'm so glad I asked because it's very encouraging and I already
Yeah.
feel a little bit less fearful.
Yeah. Yeah. And you know, and the fear is part of the cultural conditioning. And it's just really good that you have the courage to share the fear, you know, with others. Because that's the beginning of the shift, you know, because you're not the only person who is afraid of death, you know.
Yeah. I'm sure I'm not.
Yeah.
Thank
Yeah.
you so much. I really appreciate it. You've been so helpful. I'm
Thank
looking
you.
forward to your meditation.
Yes. Thank you for asking, Isabel. That's really great. Is there anyone else you would like to ask or share something?
Oh,
Amy.
Sherwin. Yeah,
Yes,
what is
please.
the fear? My fear about death is that it's gonna hurt and I'm gonna be so scared of the pain, like it's going to feel horrible. And also that I'll have so many regrets that I'll be like resisting, like, no, I don't want to die. And that resistance is gonna make the experience like awful.
But why can't you check out your regrets and repair those? I mean, start today or tomorrow, that's one of the things about the reflections of that on death is it motivates us to repair, and it's easy to forgive, and we can easy also ask for forgiveness because we are so motivated in the way you're saying, because that, that sense of urgency needs to translate into action. Can you do that?
Yeah, I can. I resist that. So I guess
Why?
it's just a
Why do you?
pattern of resistance.
Because why? Do you know why?
I guess like fear that it'll be hard and I'll feel bad and like I'll be the one who was bad and I guess just that it'll be hard and uncomfortable.
But dying with a lot of regrets is even harder, and then you can't move anymore and do anything because so and now you're still young. So you do one step at a time, one and they take a break and then the next one, and then it's not gonna be that hard. But when once you're on your deathbed and you can't move, you can't do anything anymore, that's because you wanna have that in mind. So it is because that's the ultimate hardness, and then it's too late. And life is just sometimes really hard. I mean, that's why we all came to the Dhamma because of that. Yeah, there's no way around it, other than increasing our capacity for resilience and being with discomfort. There is no insight into the way things are without the capacity of allowing discomfort. No way. Yeah, it's not necessarily the happiest news, but once you got used to it, it will make you strong. Because that's what we need to be in order for if you want to be enlightened, you need to be strong, and you get stronger because there's more and more of that, those old patterns are liberated. The energy is set free and we get more strong, embodied. Yeah.
Thank you very much.
Yeah, thank you. Patty, hi. We can't hear you, Patty.
Hi, can you hear me now?
Now we can.
Thank you. I love this topic. This is
You're
one of
so
my
tiny. You're so tiny on your screen, like a dwarf. Can you come a bit closer?
I'll try to get the screen closer.
It's really funny. Okay, I see a bit better now.
Okay, thank you.
Yeah.
I love this topic and I practice the five recollections every day, at least twice a day, sometimes more often.
Wow, you're amazing. You are more than a monastic practicing.
Well, not only in that, not in any other way. But what's interesting is I've lost a lot of friends over my lifetime. Now I'm of an age where it's expected, but when I was in my 20s, 30s, and 40s, I lost a lot of friends.
Oh.
And I'm very familiar with loss and with grief. And now that I'm of an age when people aren't surprised when my friends are dying. I was diagnosed with a progressive illness that's probably, though there's no certainty, is probably going to be how I die. And I'm trying to come to peace with the fact that that's probably how I'm going to die. And the recollections help me a lot because I know I'm not exempted. I know that that's my nature and I know that that's inevitable.
Yes.
Nevertheless, having said all that, it's still hard to say goodbye to people who leave before me. I have more problems saying goodbye. I see my attachment to the people that are dear to me and everyone I love and everything that's dear to me. I know they're of the nature to change. I know that separation from them is inevitable. And yet, I struggle with that separation.
Yeah. As you know, that's just the other side of love, you know. You can't have it's very hard, you know, you need to be very far along the path to love without any attachment. It's just, you know, it's just part and parcel of this, you know, of who we are. I think, you know, that we love and that we have, you know, really close and dear ones and you know, and that's a wonderful thing, but it has like a price, you know, that then when we lose them, it can be very painful, yeah. But you know, if you keep on reflecting in the way you do, because you say you do those five subjects of frequent recollection, which I can later share with people, is it's just, you know, it's also. There's also something beautiful about that, I think, you know. But it takes some time for that to, you know, that we can connect with that. The beauty, you know, of how it all is, you know, that we emerge out of the planet Earth through our mothers and then we move back into it and we meet other people on the way and, you know, and there's these resonances and then that's love, you know, for us. We experience that in that way. And if we can really fully experience all of it, it just opens the mind and the heart more and more. Even the heart experience is like losing a loved one, you know. Yeah. And this is, it's, there's also something really very deeply beautiful about it, you know. And meeting, you know, with other people who have losses like that and sharing with them, I think can be very helpful, you know. There's lots of, you know, grief work. And using that, you know, to become more integrated with the way life really is, you know, and become more compassionate and you know, slow down and become more embodied, you know, through taking all of that in as it is. I think that's what we can do, you know, with all of those difficult things like getting a diagnosis, you know, which might be an illness, you know, we will maybe die from. And I, you know, I always see in my life, you know, whenever I have some really difficult things where my whole system would just like to go numb, you know, and go to sleep or something and not deal with it. Whenever I could stay with it, you know, and open up to it, it has, you know, it has matured me and made me a more And always they opened up, you know, the next step, which arose out of the metabolizing of that which seemed so difficult, you know. Once I really did it, you know, one bite at a time, not overdoing it, but gently, you know, continuing with it and turning towards it, it has always, you know, led to something more fulfilling than what I originally thought, you know. Because the thinking mind just wants to basically explain why aversion is the right thing, you know. But if you just don't allow that, it just, you see, okay, that's what the system wants, but I'm just adding mindfulness to all of this. You know, there's not only the difficult experience in my life, but on top of it, I'm also aware of the aversion towards it. And then all of it is included, you know, in awareness, the difficult experience and the aversion and the sadness and the wish it might be different and all of that all together, all of it is allowed to be what it is. And all of it can just stay here, doesn't need to change. You know, and then in that kind of softening towards all of this, that's where the alchemy happens, you know. And it's kind
Thank
of
you.
counterintuitive, you know, because it feels like that can't be the answer, you know. I need to control it, I need to take it in my hand, but it is, you know. When still we do things, we go to the doctor, we take medication, we whatever, do exercise, we do what we can, you know. But not with the sense of like kind of trying to escape from something, but more like, you know, being in relationship and allowing ourselves to be changed by what we experience, you know, to become more real. And we need other people for that, you know, because we need to be able to, you know, lean on other people when we are in a real dark place, you know, until it opens up again. Sangha, you know, is so important, yeah. It's one of the three refuges because of that fact. Thank you for sharing, Patty.
Thank you.
Yeah. Anyone else would like to share about this? Okay, so maybe then we can do our guided meditation today. Well, is there announcements actually, Bill? Sorry.
Well, we actually did announcements while you were disconnected, so I just
Okay.
wanted to reiterate for anybody who joined us or forgot about Dhamma. The Dhamma is propelled forward by your generosity. I'm going to post again the link to the Saranaloka Foundation's or the Aloka Vihara
No,
organization's.
Saranaloka Foundation is
Okay,
correct.
all right. Well, the link does work. So anyway, I did post the link
Thank you.
on your chat.
Yes. So the support foundation is called Saranaloka Support Foundation and it supports the Aloka Earth Room where I am and also Parayana Vihara. That's where Ayananda Bodhi is. And before that was called Aloka Vihara, but it just changed its name.
Right.
Just like maybe 1 or 2 weeks ago, yes. Okay. So thank you so much for making that available. And now we have like a good 35 minutes or so for a meditation together. And you know, just coming into your bodies. You know, taking a screenshot, how are you right now physically, emotionally, and mentally? After hearing the sharings, how you feel about this? and allowing the breath to take you into the body. And sensing the aliveness in your body, the inner flow, maybe even a subtle hum, a vibration. And if the mind wanders off, you know, just gently bring it back. And just drop really into the body and, you know, even sensing the ground underneath where you are sitting. No pushing. Just like directing the mind. And just, you know, as we are sensing the soil underneath where we are sitting, that's the, you know, the body of the planet where our bodies have emerged out of. And where they will go back into. And until that time, you know, those bodies are fully embedded in the biosphere through eating, drinking, going to the bathroom, breathing. We never cut the umbilical cord. We totally belong. And, you know, when we see the body in this much vaster context, it takes away some of the obsession, you know, with me and mine, because we never have been separate. And we never will be. It's just a delusion of the mind. There have been, you know, thousands of generations before us, you know, leading us back into deep time, many different life forms, and these very sophisticated bodies. They are quite recent. emergence from the planet in evolutionary time. And because, you know, so many other forms have died, this process of evolution and complexification could actually happen. So without death, there is no growth. It's part of how life lives. Dying is not the opposite of life. Dying is just the opposite of birth. Life goes on. And that's just something to really take that in. And, you know, just recently, I think yesterday, you know, a friend was explaining to me how, you know, how a fetus, you know, actually starts to grow in the womb of a mother. It's like, you know, when the blood, the menstrual blood isn't shed, but it stays in the body, and then the blood starts to interact with itself, you know, through very fast movement, and then through that, through this hitting of the blood cells against each other, you know, the heart forms first. The heart forms out of that, and then around the heart, the body starts to emerge. So it's an absolute, you know, fluid process, and death is part of that. Death is not the end of it. Death is just part of how this process operates in order to revitalize itself. It goes back, you know, when all of the life energy has been drained out of it. It goes back into the bigger body of the earth, and then it re-emerges, revitalized. And to us, you know, it appears to be like a great loss and everything is going wrong. But in the big picture, it's a very awesome process of continuation. And the Dharma of death, the recollection of death, is a preparation for that vastness from which we have emerged. To kind of tune into that. Rather than, you know, being stuck in the contracting, in the fear, in a snapshot, you know, which is just like a snapshot of the whole journey, and holding on to that. So this recollection of death, which I'm going to share with you today, has three main themes. And those main themes are subdivided into three sub-themes. There's altogether 9 recollections. And we're just starting by, you know, continuing sitting and breathing. And then the first main theme is death is inevitable. And just allow that to drop in into the mind, into the heart, into the body. Death is inevitable. Then how do we know this? Every other being who lived before me has died. Powerful kings and queens of the past, presidents, the wealthy, the famous, the glorious, the holy ones, all have died. I can't be an exception. And allow that to sink in. Death comes along at the moment of birth. We always think death lies in the future, but actually at the moment I'm born, my death has co-arisen, always lurking in the background. When causes and conditions come, I have to die. Every moment I'm moving ever closer to death. At morning, when the sun rises, it moves ever closer to sunset. So from birth, prime of life, to old age, ever closer to death every year, month, day, hour, minute, second, I draw closer to my end. And just allowing that to sink in, you know, and noticing if there's a resistance in the body, in the mind, the heart. That's fine, you know, just letting it be. That's okay. That's to be expected. And then the arrival of death is uncertain. The time of death is unpredictable. We can die as babies, as children, as adolescents, the prime of life, the middle age, old age. We don't know when. And the place of my death is also unpredictable. Can be in my home, my bed, can be on a trip, in the car, the plane, a hospital room, in the forest, in the ocean, friend's home. And the cause of death is also unpredictable. It can be old age, it can be a stroke, cancer, an accident. climb. You simply can't know that. And when we die, we have to relinquish everything. All material possessions and status, position, name, fame, all external acquisitions, everything has to be left behind. And all who are near and dear to me have to be left behind as well. Children and partners, spouses, friends, parents, relatives, Sangha members, pets, everybody has to be left behind. And my body and my personality, on whom my whole identity is based, also has to be left behind, to be given up. And the only thing we can take with us is not really a thing, but it's the disposition of our minds and character, which we have been creating, over lifetimes, in particular this lifetime, the karmic volitions. That's what comes with us. Not us, like as who we are right now, but this, the mainstream is going to come back in a different body. And the situation of that body and the body itself is in relationship to the quality of the mindstream. But that is a powerful motivation for practice, I would think. And if you can't really relate to that, that's fine as well. Then we can maybe only, consider that we would like to die with as little regret as we can. So that's, those nine reflections. And then, we can go over the three main themes one more time. First one is death is inevitable. Second one is the arrival of death is uncertain. And the last one is when we die, we have to relinquish everything. Then we can, those three statements, we can wrap them up into one statement. Just simply, death is inevitable. Comes along with birth. And death is not the opposite of life. Death is the opposite of life, of birth. I have a really beautiful poem by Venerable Thich Nhat Hanh, which speaks to this in a very powerful way. And he says, exquisite the rose on her way to the compost. Fertile the compost on its way to the rose. Wheeling my barrow of dung, impermanence greets me in beauty. Exquisite the rose on her way to the compost. Fertile the compost on its way to the rose. Wheeling my barrow of dung, impermanence greets me in beauty. And the barrow of dung, you know, that could be the body. But if we see it in this big picture context, there's a tremendous beauty and elegance in the process, which we can learn to sense into, appreciate, consider, and, you know, become more consciously part of that. Everything feeds on something. And everything supports and is supported. And the Venerable Thich Nhat Hanh so beautifully called that interbeing. And, you know, if we see it in that way, then there's nothing to fear, really. It's more like it's just the transformation and like a wave, you know, on the surface of the ocean. It emerges out of it and then it goes back into it and nothing is lost. So the web of life, you know, arising in this multitude of forms. And all forms, you know, an ant or a human being, a tree, a house, it all emerges out of the planet. And at one point it goes back into it and then there's new forms emerging and composting, and that's amazing. We can learn, you know, to see ourselves as embedded in that process. And the life forms which die, they offer food for the new life forms to emerge. And when we go in a forest, you know, we can see that very beautiful, how the broken and the fallen fit in along with the new and the fresh. And it all belongs together. And in nature, you know, birth, aging, and death are of equal value to the whole system, and there is absolutely no waste. But it can easily get lost, you know, if we don't consider it, contemplate it.